but I think we've got him on the line now.
Well, good day, fellas.
Hey, what's up? Ian, Malcolm, welcome to the Flood Show, and thanks for joining us tonight. It's my first time actually running a space, so I'm kind of figuring these controls out as we go, but thanks for taking time tonight to hang out with us and chat a little bit.
Well, I'll tell you, it's if there's anything I can do to help make the ride smoother or reduce turbulence, let me know. I'm happy to try and help with the controls, and I'm just humbled to be here with you guys and to be on the other side of the table. I'm normally asking some of the questions. I'll try and flip that script and maybe provide some interesting answers or thought provoking ones in the process here on this expedition that we're about to embark on. So again, just excited to be with you guys and to learn about your program and provide some thoughts along the way.
Well, that's awesome, man. Thank you. And I've noticed I've only been on Twitter maybe for a little bit close to a year now, but I keep an eye on spaces and I've been kind of podcasting on the JQ for about 2 years, and I've noticed that you actually run quite a few spaces. You're very active on Twitter. I noticed that you've accrued a pretty good size account as well, and I have a lot of friends that have been making accounts on Twitter forever. They get banned, they get shadow banned, they get suppressed. You've managed to kind of avoid most of that, and I think that's probably because you're smart about your approach. I guess first off, I would just kind of start. You don't really have to answer anything that you don't want to. I know that a lot of people, their privacy is very important. But how did you kind of come across the JQ? How would you kind of nutshell the JQ? And can you tell us what made you kind of take a leadership role? I mean, I consider a leadership role in initiating discussions, in putting together what have been some very large spaces, and kind of bringing this to the forefront of people's consciousness.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, it's actually been kind of a bit of a roundabout journey, I would say, because of the fact that while I've landed here, and I've certainly made it the focal point of a lot of the activity that I have on this platform, it's not something that I arrived at directly, and I say that because it's actually only been really the last couple of years. Frankly, it was a little bit prior to the entire COVID era, and then certainly during the first year or so of COVID, that all of it really, really clicked. But it's basically been the result of a long time of not only political interest, but also just kind of a personal curiosity and intrigue in kind of the meta existence of our ethos, of our culture, certainly of the political kind of embodiment of that culture, but going all the way back to essentially, I think 9/11 is probably a pretty penultimate moment for a lot of individuals, especially if you take any interest in kind of Western politics, because up through that point, really the most earth-shattering things of maybe the 30, 40 years that preceded it would be primarily JFK and Nixon, right? And we'll come back to that in perhaps a second, because, you know, lo and behold, those are actually part of this same machine that I try to expose at this point. But to kind of hyper-focus, you know, post 9/11, I think anybody and everybody looked at politics and they watched as the United States made this very public effort to embark on its democracy project, they called it, in the Middle East, and proceeded to basically watch for 20 years as they, quote unquote, nation built all around Israel. And pretty much everybody just went along with it under this guise that they were fighting, you know, Muslim extremists and fighting jihad and all this other kind of stuff. But whether it was the Middle Eastern conflict, whether it was the southern border, whether it was the culture wars, I basically noticed this continuous undercurrent, let's call it, where no matter what was taking place and which micro topic you focused on, whether it was abortion, the border, taxation, the economy, it almost always seemed like there were intentional efforts to demoralize the past, to create chaos in the present, and to do it to ensure a future in which the government would have more and more and more control over the masses. And for the longest time, you know, I would look at kind of, let's think of them as alt-right intellects. And I would look at folks like Alex Jones once upon a time. Prior to him, it was Tucker Carlson. Post Alex Jones, it was at one point Curtis Yarvin. And I was looking at all these different individuals, and I was recognizing that there is a pattern, that the pattern is continuous cultural decline, economic impoverishment, and political federal centralization, right? Removal of the rights of the states, removal essentially of the rights of the people, and that all of that power continuously concentrated in a way that was, at the end of the day, antithetical to the benefits, the liberties, the freedoms of its citizenry. And so you can look at things like, since I brought up 9/11, we could look at the Patriot Act, and you start to look at it in retrospect, and you're like, okay, so wait a second. 2 to 3 weeks after 9/11, Washington, D.C., which moves at, you know, a snail's pace on a good day, was able to construct hundreds, thousands of pages of legislation that basically allowed for, after its signing, for the government to more or less spy on its citizenry without warrants across all of their digital communications, right? And it's like, where is this coming from? Why is this possible? And we've seen kind of the same things, and I'm getting a little bit of a echo on your end, Flood, but we're, you know, whether it's the Patriot Act all the way up through the emergency kind of rollout, the emergency authorization acts during COVID, all of these things, they always seemed beyond scripted. It seems beyond premeditated. And again, just in further centralization of the powers that be. And so, you know, when it comes to the JQ, it was not really a thing that I landed on. It was more or less the conclusion of all of these different curiosities and peeling all of these things back, and then recognizing whether it's the cultural decline, which is largely through the media, music, pop culture, et cetera, through the financial system, which was just enslaving the masses, through the politicians, which were continuously prioritizing largely Israeli interests to that of their own citizenry, whether it was immigration, where the politicians, you know, even Trump with his, I'm going to build a wall. He couldn't get his $6 billion for the wall, but Israel and Ukraine get $300 to $400 to maybe even $500 billion over the course of 2.5 years. And it's like, something is wrong here. And so it's a very long-winded, but hopefully somewhat comprehensive answer as to how I kind of came to some of these conclusions and areas of focus.
Oh, I think it's a brilliant answer. And I think it kind of illustrates a natural noticing, like you weren't necessarily radicalized by a far right political entity or anything like that, but you just were paying attention and you saw, you know, the slow degradation of society. You actually, you know, mentioning 9/11, I often talk about the 9/11 people, because there were a lot of people that were pretty clued in even immediately after 9/11. And I always think that, you know, I always think about them with some empathy and some compassion, because it was probably another 20 years where I just personally bought into the entire, you know, the whole corporate chase, the whole American dream. Everybody was kind of out being an individual. They were out with their own plans, and they were trying to accomplish their own goals, and really was completely asleep to this until some really good friends kind of beat me over the head with it. I think a lot of us kind of ended up going down, you know, the Alex Jones pathway towards secret societies and clandestine operations. And we kind of saw the same things, but they didn't make sense until somebody just hit me over the head and said, look, it's the Jews. And I always felt like it would have been better if I were paying attention and I would have noticed the same thing. So over this long course of you kind of coming to this awareness, it had to be a little bit demoralizing, you know, to kind of see things happening and think there must be a reason for this, and then eventually end up at the JQ. Was it demoralizing for you? Was it tough?
And you know, it's interesting that you say that because it goes back to this overarching thesis, which is essentially this concept of the JQ and this idea that if you go back to Yuri Bemenov and this idea of demoralization campaigns that are run by the powers that be, you know, he kind of walked through this whole step-by-step process, which is more or less at the end of the day to take normality to construct chaos, to use the chaos to present a new norm, and then through normalization to have that new norm become the new thing from which you're going to kind of further the process and ever kind of degrade the people. And it was so bizarre because I think everybody has different upbringings. They've got different value structures and all those things. And it doesn't matter if you're looking through a religious lens or a pop culture lens. For the purposes of podcasts, I usually focus on things like Lord of the Rings, Harry Potter, Star Wars, because these are concepts and stories that are kind of, you know, generations in the making. And maybe not with Harry Potter at this point. I suppose it's two generations, but they're things that are relatable for the masses. And I say this because, you know, whether your value structure is built on fiction, whether it's the Iliad and the Odyssey all the way up to Star Wars, or whether it's religious in nature, you know, everybody has this sense of good and evil. And inherent in that, at least from my frame of reference, was this idea that your people are of value, that your culture is something to take pride in. And I always found it, to your point, demoralizing because as I kind of went from childhood and adolescence into adulthood, I started to look around and I noticed that there was this very strange divide, which at the time I thought was very left-right centric. It was Republicans and Democrats. And for some reason, the Democrats seemed to not care about their heritage, their history, their past. They seemed excited to mock, for example, the, let's just say, if you look at the Union and the Confederacy, they seemed giddy to mock the Confederate soldiers, the things they stood for, the lands and the history that they embodied. And look, I'm not saying that slavery was a good thing, like obviously not, but I did look at that and I said, well, let's be real, guys. I mean, everyone's been enslaved. Every peoples were enslaved. Some of the first slaves in the United States were the Irish of all people. And I started to look at the history and to recognize, okay, the people that are constantly demoralizing me, for some reason, their worldview is not based in a reality. It's based in myths that they've been told largely by academia and the media. And they've been convinced, they've essentially been conned into more or less hating the very things and histories and cultures that they are descendants of. And it was so weird because you would look at somebody whose family might have been around since the Civil War, and yet they were happy to take their legacy, their ancestors, and to throw them under the bus and to suggest, you know what, they were inherently bad. The people that are coming across the border illegally, they have every right to be here as I do, even though my family's fought for these concepts. And I'm not speaking to me when I say my family. I mean, you know, in this thesis, let's say, or the theory, it was like basically the old has no moral high ground, no claim to a land, a rights, a people, et cetera. And then what was so odd was to recognize that the same people, whether on the left that disagreed with me, that there's something about American or Western white culture that should be, you know, kind of maintained and that should be revered, whether it was the left who seemed hell-bent on destroying it or the right, which seemed kind of interested in protecting it, all of the people simultaneously agreed that we had to ensure the protection of Israel, of its culture, of its people, of its religion, and that that was somehow uniquely different. And so I say this just because even, you know, long before I awoke to the JQ, what I did recognize is that whether it was the Israelis or whether it was somebody coming across the southern border from Mexico, Brazil, whatever, that there was that everybody in the West was perfectly happy to celebrate the cultures of everyone but the white Western Christian male kind of heterosexual peoples. And it was a continuous reaction to those things that I noticed that something was fundamentally wrong with the Western world, that people were intentionally being demoralized and taught that they, you know, for whatever the reason was, I didn't really understand it back in the day, but that the white Christian West was perfectly happy committing cultural and geopolitical seppuku in the name of pop culture. And so while I think many other people were being demoralized with that messaging, I, a long time ago, recognized that I was perfectly willing and comfortable, for whatever reason, maybe I'm a sociopath, but I was perfectly comfortable being the I don't want to call it revolutionary, but I was happy to be the devil's advocate that would say, no, bullshit. I take pride in white Christian European heritage. I take pride in the value structure that those people created, and the Enlightenment, the Renaissance, all the cultural beauty and splendor and wonder that came from those people. And I don't care if that's offensive to anybody else. And if you want me to believe that it is offensive and that I should be quiet and not take pride in that, well, then that tells me that you, who is saying that I can't have pride but everybody else can in their heritage, that you're bigots. And I kind of took that as a badge of honor to say, I've thought this through. I believe that we should have equality because you know, Mr. Peoples that are championing diversity, you're suggesting that all people should have pride in their culture. Well, I'm going to do that. And when I realized that I wasn't supposed to, I realized that something was fundamentally wrong. And it was, again, just another example of how you notice there are these continuous patterns of overt demoralization that for some, quote unquote, some reason at the time, I looked around and I couldn't understand where that was coming from. And then, you know, fast forward to today and I realize, oh, that's actually a cultural subversion tactic that is being incredibly executed at the hands of this select set of people that are very, very eager and excited, as wild as it sounds, for the literal genocide and the figurative genocide of the white race. And I know that might sound hyperbolic, but I think whether we look at what's being done historically in Christian nations under things like the Bolsheviks, where there was literal genocide of tens of millions of white Christians,
yes,
or today, where I can't turn on a television in any Western world, the United States, you could be sitting in Miami, Florida, you can be sitting in London, England, you turn on the television and without fail, two out of five, three out of five, four out of five, five out of the five commercials are going to be a black man with a white woman. And that is every bit as much of a soft genocide as the literal execution of tens of millions of Christians under the Bolsheviks was a literal genocide. And the point of these things, it can't be understated. We can't place enough importance on it because we have to wake up the masses to it. Because if we don't, then we will just continue this slide into what I believe is kind of a Zionist technocratic future that's really, really ugly for everybody involved.
I knew this was going to be a fantastic interview. You hit on a lot of things during that. And I think one of the most important things is you kind of mentioned that when you're aware of this cultural Marxist sort of Besmanovian demoralization tactic, something, by the way, which he pointed out clearly in the early 80s, I wasn't aware of any of these things. One day, Don Lemon mentioned that white men were the most dangerous people in America. And a lot of people, I think, may remember when he said that. I know I've seen it clipped several times, but it hit me then. And it was like a real revelation that there was suddenly, like, it just all clicked and there is an anti-white agenda in the media. And I kind of started looking backwards and kind of going through history. And then you start to see the long march through the institutions start to take shape, and you begin to realize, and this was kind of like taking the whole black pill all at once. You begin to realize that you grew up in a society that deracinated you, it demoralized you, it kind of led you away from family values, and all these things just kind of started to become apparent. And I think you kind of hit it on the head there. Like, once you notice the program, it kind of doesn't affect you as much anymore. Like, you don't really play into the mind games and the psyops and some of the, you know, basically just the aspects of the color revolution that's happening here. But you begin to realize that you're in a culture war, and you don't know if you're on one side of the battle or the other, or if you're the prize, or, you know, kind of where you stand within that. But there definitely is a war on white cultures. And I think I started looking backwards and realizing that history had been misrepresented, that so many things that we were taught maybe didn't exactly happen the way that we were told, or the politics were different than what we were told, and begin to kind of slowly realize that the history I believed was written by the victors of 1945. And even if you go back that far, you will see that even before then, going back to World War One, and even prior to World War One, this long march has been going on for a very long time. And it's just staggering how fast the revelations come. But the fact that you are aware of it, that does kind of make it different now. This becomes more of a challenge, right? It's you feel the impetus, like you mentioned, to stand up and say, no, we're going to be contrary to this. We're going to stand against this narrative. How important is, I mean, obviously the narrative is kind of what we all are waking up from, but how important is control of the narrative to success in our future, in your opinion?
Well, I mean, I think it first depends on how you define success and what it is that we're either spiritually or intellectually at war with, or actually physically at war with, depending on where you are in the world. And I say that because, I mean, what we are witnessing right now, if you're in the West, you are watching the result of decades of subversion of your nation. It doesn't matter if you're in Western Europe or if you're in particular in the United States, you are seeing the byproduct of essentially the entanglement of your entire political machine, the subversion of all of its tentacles, and the utilization of that financial, political, and that military might, which is essentially being parasitically drained and stolen for the near exclusive, if not entirely exclusive, benefit of a foreign nation, which is, as a result, the American entanglement in this growing Middle Eastern conflict, which is not only now the complete destruction and genocide of the Palestinians in Gaza, which the United States more or less funded, but is now the expansion of that military endeavor into Syria, where not only are we witnessing Israel essentially stirring up further conflict, which very well might turn into geopolitical World War III, which, of course, if that happens, the United States is going to fully support those efforts because it's entirely cucked by the state of Israel. But you're also, terrifyingly, you're seeing two things that are going to result from that. Number one is going to be the outpouring of refugees, quote unquote, which are going to be shipped from Syria and other surrounding nations into Western Europe and into the United States to further diminish the once homogenous Western white world, which will add to the, you know, the growing, what would you call it, contention that is inevitable amidst this growing levels of diversity in those Western worlds. But you're also going to see, as a result of the outpouring of money, of troops, of let's just call them interests to the Middle East on behalf of the U.S. in particular, you're going to see the laws are going to be put in place to ensure that you can't speak out against the ever-growing subversion of your nation and enslavement of your people, your money, your prosperity for those foreign interests. So it's really wild. I mean, you're essentially seeing, so it's ironic because the television, the media, big technology, you know, they all push out the message of reparations, demanding that quote unquote whites repay quote unquote blacks for their enslavement. And of course, the irony there being that it was disproportionately Jews that were behind the transatlantic slave trade, the ownership of slaves, the selling of those slaves in the New World. Some statistics say as many as 70% of the slave ownership in the New World was at the hands of Jews. That number, you know, you can, of course, debate it, you can argue it, et cetera. But there's, you know, the let's just say the Jewish fingerprints are all over the slave trade. But nonetheless, the media, disproportionately owned by Jews, blame whites for slavery, demanding reparations for blacks. And I bring this up just because it is, in fact, all Westerners at this point that are basically owed reparations for the endless outpouring of money, funding, etc., to Israel.
Yes.
Right? We've seen 3 decades now of it. And the last president that really put up any opposition to it was JFK, and we saw what happened to him. And so my point is just that we're seeing this military conflict ever increase as it does. We're going to see, laws put in place to prohibit you from speaking out against it. And it just goes to show how kind of entire the subversion is of the system at this point.
Yeah, I see the same thing, and I actually see kind of with the incoming administration that the people who will be targeted the most with this oppression are the people who actually voted in the most Zionist administration that we've ever seen, and I think that's coming up soon. But I may be skipping ahead just a little bit. Yeah, what's interesting is I've noticed that no matter how good you get at history, no matter how much you learn, and you're right, the more that you look. Everything becomes arguable, and you will find those Jewish fingerprints on the slave trade. You'll find them on the Caribbean. You'll find them on the I guess the exploitation of like sugar and rum and all of the New World discoveries were almost immediately kind of taken over by this same group of people. Slaves were involved in all of this. We could take that back to Spain. You can just kind of follow these fingerprints way back through history until eventually history itself kind of disappears. And even if you learn all of the crazy facts about who is really behind things like the slave trade, who owns the media, who makes up 90% of the presidential cabinet, all of these things that are overwhelmingly, I guess you would call them like mind-blowing facts about Jews, they are actually already listed as in the definition of anti-Semitism as anti-Semitic and hateful and hate speech. And you begin to kind of realize that the corral's already been built around what you can talk about. Of course, we see people getting shadow banned, getting demonetized, getting just completely wiped off of X and Twitter and so-called free speech platforms. At the same time, I've noticed that the truth doesn't really matter, at least to the so-called political left. They don't really care about the facts, like even when you can prove them wrong about particular things. And I realize that people that are caught in the right-left paradigm are kind of stuck in that paradigm, and it's really hard to step back and see the puppet master running both puppets. But did it shock you to find out that like you could win, you could literally throw these facts out all day, and either people just don't care, or they're just willing to completely overlook those facts just to continue to drive their political agenda. I mean, isn't that, was that frightening? Like, that's frightening to me that you're not dealing with people that care about truth. And I think that's another thing that we as whites particularly value is truth. Have you seen that disparity?
Yeah, and I'll tell you, I do think, and sometimes I get in hot water because I talk a lot about race realism. I talk a lot about the JQ and all these things. I also don't I don't lionize, let's just say, whites as the only group of people capable of some of these more complex thoughts or more righteous endeavors. I do think that there's people of kind of all races, creeds. I mean, even amongst Jews, I have folks like Simon Dixon. I regularly am kind of honored to be in spaces and conversations with. He has a Jewish mother, but he's very vocally against Jewish supremacy, against Zionism, against central banking, which he is happy to say is overtly kind of a Jewish construct. And so, there's all kinds of people out there. But what I would say to that question on double standards is, especially in the left-right paradigm, a long time ago, I recognized that this is obviously something that is self-evident to anyone with kind of a half a clue. And as a really easy example, I would talk with individuals that would identify, let's just say, as Democrats, and they would say, "My body, my choice." And I would sit down with them and I would say, "Okay, let's unpack that." And in some ways, I think being kind of pro-choice, maybe that's a societally beneficial position to take. It might not be the one that kind of emotionally I would want to attach myself to, or maybe morally would think is righteous. But you could read Super Freakonomics, which makes a very interesting argument that roughly one generation, let's call it 16 to 20 years after abortion was legalized, crime drastically decreased in major cities all across America. Now, that's probably like we could just be reasonably intelligent individuals and discern that that's likely a result of unwanted babies not being born to mothers and fathers that were probably sexually reckless or promiscuous that weren't going to do a great job raising them, right? And so I say that just to say that, look, there's an argument to be made that maybe pro-choice is socially beneficial. But then I would sit down with them. And I would say, okay, so you're pro-choice. All right, fine. What is your position on the death penalty? And they would say, well, I'm opposed to that. And I would say, okay, why? And they would say, well, because why should we ever allow somebody to take a life? And then I look at them and I twist my neck and I say, okay, now how can you hold those two positions simultaneously? And then ironically, I would turn around to the Republican and I would say, wait a second, you're pro-life, but you're pro, I don't want to say death penalty, but maybe that's the right term for it, right? How can you hold those two positions simultaneously? And then they would twist their neck and they would say, I don't see why it's contradictory. And it's like, huh, wait, hang on, hang on. So you're against ever killing a baby, even if it maybe is somehow justifiable, but you're in favor of killing the criminal because you think it's okay to take a life, right? And that's a judgment call. And frankly, I do find the liberal position in that specific case to be more hypocritical. But nonetheless, I'm just trying to make the point. And then you could also extract in the vaccines where the people that were my body, my choice were no, you have to get the shot. And the people that were pro-life were, you know, saying you can't tell me what to do with my body, which I found, you know, it's just an extension of the same hypocritical stance where people take political positions because they don't necessarily support fundamental ideals. They support talking points based on what their politicians feed them. And so I just use those as examples of, you know, this inability for many, many, many people to critically think through issues. I don't know if it's necessarily, you know, the lack of IQ or if it's the prevalence of propaganda and the ability of the machine to just instill its ideals in its people rather than having them critically think through them. But I, you know, I'm just a person that I always found it interesting to sit down with a cup of coffee or a bottle of wine or whatever was my poison of choice for the day with close friends that I thought were thoughtful individuals and to unpack the world at large. And I think, unfortunately, a lot of people are just so caught up in the next episode of their favorite show, the next, you know, NFL game, whatever it is, that they're looking to just kind of cope and get through the days with no interest in ever understanding why we're here, trying to unpack what actually matters in the world and trying to put a lot of interest or thought into these more complex items. So not sure if that answers it at all, you know, kind of acutely, but kind of a rambling response for you.
No, I think that's fantastic. Actually, it's probably the most succinctly I've heard it put. But essentially, a lot of people are just NPCs that get their positions from CNN or Fox News, you know, prior to 2020. And a lot of those people just simply parrot what they've been programmed with on television. And you know, I've often blamed that. Maybe I'm a little bit of a conspiracist. I often blame this on propaganda. I know that the television is essentially telling people what to think, the same way that polls tell you how to vote. And a lot of people are very susceptible to this kind of programming. And you'd mentioned that there's a massive lack of critical thinking, which I completely agree with. And one of the only ways that you can really kind of try to snap people out of that, or at least make them aware of it, is to point out these hypocrisies. And these are the things that should stick out the most to people who are generally arguing moral positions, but yet they don't see their own reflection in the mirror. And I'll probably use a lot of those kind of analogies because a lot of the analogies that we actually use are based on these dynamics, like Israel's inability to see its own reflection. They see everything as as sort of an attack. They claim victimhood status through just about anything, while they're literally committing genocide in other parts of the world. We've seen this used as a political tactic. We've seen this used in the media ad infinitum, to the point where I'm not sure that we've ever seen anything else. You know, and I feel bad for younger people because I was a Gen X person. I grew up in the 80s. We were taught civics. We were taught to be patriots. We were taught love for our country. But somewhere between there and the time I realized that we were we were being invaded, at least by the media, that had completely changed, and that the kids that were coming out of school were coming out essentially Marxist, communist. And then as I looked further into, you know, kind of the JQ, realizing that all these things had their roots in Bolshevism, and particularly in the Russian Revolution. Suddenly I found myself having to become a student of history and having to go back and, you know, read Mein Kampf. There's so many stereotypes that you feel along the way. But the reason those are stereotypes is because this path has been well laid with traps. I remember Janet Reno saying that a terrorist was a Midwesterner who believed in Christian values, who quoted the Bible. And I thought, what a weird thing to say. But I wasn't conscious enough during the Clinton administration for that to throw any red flags or alarm bells. And I really feel almost like, I want to say ashamed, but I just feel it was unfortunate that I wasn't aware enough at the time to pay attention. But I was bought into the individualism thing. And it was very easy as an American to become anesthetized by media, culture, and all of these things, which were slowly changing, you know, away from traditional values. And, you know, we were taught this was just progress. This was just liberal values, you know, and that traditionalist values were on the decline and liberal values were, you know, were on the ebb. And I thought, well, maybe this is just the normal cycle of things. But it was basically an internal monologue of normalizing these things to myself. And I think a lot of people do that, and the media helps them, you know. And so... Once I became aware of that, you kind of start working on, well, where is the problem? Where can we actually make a difference? How can we deprogram some of these things? And I've always landed on media control. I know that a lot of people think that more physical things need to happen. A lot of people talk about, you know, potential violence. Yeah, I think generally I try to steer away from those ideas just because that's not how they accomplished this cultural, you know, I don't want to call it a victory because I don't think they've won yet. I think there are still embers of a culturally sovereign people here, but those need to be stoked a little bit. And so I've kind of went into propaganda and started doing audiobooks, just little things I thought might make a difference. But I think that's where we're headed. It's kind of where I want to ask my next question is, do you see you've talked to a lot of people, you've had a lot of really big spaces. You've talked to some people that have probably been aware of this stuff for a long time. You've talked to other people that have probably just become aware of this stuff. In your mind, is there a way that we can counter this programming? It's very deep, and I think it's taken generations to get here. Is it going to be a long march out, or is it possible that, you know, the natural cycle of things could happen? And let's just say, I'm sure you've heard the term 109. There have been 109 expulsions from countries of the Jews. Do you think we're just headed to 110 automatically, or is there some way that we can kind of win back the long war? I mean, it may be generational, but what's your take on that?
Yeah, so a couple things, and a crazy statistic. So it's 109, and I think at this point it's actually 110. Those are countries. There's over 1,000 written expulsions, and I've got a post that has a video that basically walks through, and there's actually a PDF available online that has the entire list. But that's just of what we have available, right? That's just on record. And I say that because there is something really curious that is going on here. And I've tried to get to the bottom of what exactly is that, because at the end of the day, if you're going to try and solve a problem, you have to understand, well, what is it that we're solving for? And when you start to try and unpack the JQ, you kind of arrive at essentially three different things. One is there's obviously a people and a nation, right? There's the nation of Israel, and that's a political machine. It's a physical location. It's a, you know, geographical place on earth, et cetera. The second is the religion. And this is a religion that essentially, fundamental to it, teaches supremacy. You can look into the Torah. You can look into the Talmud, which things get really dark. And basically in that oral tradition that is the Talmud is the notion that there are two stratifications of people. There's the Jews and there's the Goy. Now, one thing that's pretty insidious about that ideology is inherent in the Talmud is the ideology that the goy should never know about this. So it is essentially bestowed upon them that not only are non-Jews essentially animals, that's kind of what the term more or less refers to us as, but that they should protect us from this knowledge, inclusive of lying. There's even a piece in there about killing the best of the goyim if it's of benefit to Jews. There's also lots of stuff in there about usury, which is the concept of offering loans with terrible rates, etc. And so there's the religious aspect of it, which is supremacist. Then there's the third piece, which is the genetics of the Jews, the people, which I've really tried to dive into and I find really, really curious, because what you find is not only is there a religion, but there's also mitochondrial DNA markers that are unique to these people. It is a race. Some people will deny that, but I mean, a race is defined as genetically unique markers, which they have. If you then look at some of the studies on these people, what you find is that there's unusually high representations of certain things like schizophrenia, narcissistic personality disorder, all sorts of other things that are essentially loosely defined as mental illnesses, right? In the case of narcissistic personality disorder, it manifests itself through extreme envy of others, this notion of a sense of superiority, the desire to manifest that superiority by, you know, more or less controlling other people, even through things like lying, right? Which is strange because it relates back to this idea of the things taught in the Talmud. And so I say that because those three things, if we try and think through, okay, well, it's a geographic state of, or location of, or empire of, whatever you want to call it, of Israel, plus it's this religious ideology, plus it's this genetically unique people that have these weird, I shouldn't call them weird, but these unique, let's say, predispositions. Well, then how do we solve for that? There's been lots of different theories on it. There's been, like you said, the expulsions, which in many cases, ironically, in the case of Weimar Germany, you had, of course, the National Socialists, and they said, hey, you guys, you don't have to go based on genetic predisposition. This is really, really important to note. Hitler did not say, hey, Jews, you have to go. That's a complete rewrite of history. If you look at the Final Solution, it basically said Jews who were aligned to the Bolshevik ideology or that were Zionists, we want you to leave. We believe that that's the best interests of our people, etc. There's nothing in the Final Solution, the political writings of that, which there's an entire, you know, there was a conference that took place where they thought through these things. There was never anything written there about the murder, the mass execution, etc. It's really important to note that. But so Weimar Germany, Germany's going through these horrible conditions post-World War I with banks, the newspapers, the politicians, largely controlled by this singular group of people, right? Once they got through and they said, no, we're going to revolutionize the economy. We're going to get rid of this central banking approach. We're going to imprison this Rothschild member who's basically putting a stranglehold on our economic prosperity. When that ended under the National Socialists and a labor-backed economic model, which basically was the new rendition of the notes, they weren't doing a fiat currency. They were doing one based on the labor of their people. The economy had a revolution. It skyrocketed. And curiously, you could draw all sorts of parallels to, for example, the Spanish expulsions when the Jews were kicked out of Spain. And then they had the golden age of Spain that immediately followed. And so my point is just that there does seem to be a historical pattern where when groups of people have recognized that there was a common threat to their prosperity, their culture, etc., that was removed, things for whatever reason seem to improve. And I say this to set kind of a frame to try and answer your question, which is that I don't think that we need to have some kind of violent anything. I don't think people need to be rounded up. I don't think they need to be, you know, certainly harmed. I do think that we need to have a recognition that there is a problem. first and foremost. It needs to be a mass awareness campaign to that. And it's why I hold a lot of these spaces. I do the things that I do on this platform. That awareness campaign is going to lead to a mass awakening, which will spread like wildfire throughout the populace, which will then result in a mass conversation about the history, the rewriting of history, the present, the propaganda that we see in the present, and the future, and how we are going to construct a better rendition of it by removing some of these evil influences. And I say that because it's not necessarily about the people. It's about their influence and their control and their manipulation of the financial system, largely through the Federal Reserve, through the media, which is overwhelmingly owned by this group of people. As a result, you see all these propagandist ideas being shoved into all elements of all television, from children on up to the History Channel designed for a 90-year-old in a retirement home. It's propaganda galore, and that has to end. We have to look at not only that, but also the means by which we get a lot of that media, which is big technology, which whether it's Facebook with Zuckerberg, it's the co-founders of Google, their ownership of YouTube, the co-founder of Wikipedia, all these other sources that we use to try and understand the world through technology that are controlled by this exact same group of people. And so we've got to get rid of that absolute control and manipulation. And the thing that needs to supplement that is to remove that influence from the political system via essentially bribery, blackmail, threats of violence in the case of John F. Kennedy. And it's worth noting for anybody that's in this, listening to this right now, that political machine, it's not just bribery through AIPAC. It's also blackmail through things like frickin' Epstein Island, where Jeffrey Epstein's number two person, Ghislaine Maxwell, is the daughter of Robert Maxwell, one of the preeminent Mossad agents and Israeli assets, who of all people is the longtime personal friend and lawyer to none other than our Secretary of State, Anthony Blinken, who of course is not only Jewish, but to his father. So Robert Maxwell has direct lines to the Secretary of State. And so what's my point? Is that if they can't buy you through AIPAC, if they don't have to threaten you with a bullet like they did JFK, then they merely send you off to an island, videotape you doing all kinds of awful stuff, and then demand that they're going to share it with the world if you don't do what they want. And so this machine, we've got to get it out of our culture. We've got to get it out of our immigration policies, our political machine, our geopolitical interests, etc. And if we don't, folks, there's only one direction that this goes, which is the continued subservience to that foreign empire in the Middle East, until the United States has reached a point of absolute exhaustion where it doesn't have another dime to lend, another soldier to die, etc. And at that point, the nation will be nothing other than an economic corpse with a credit card bill sky high, the inability to do much of anything to retrieve that. And then at that point, it will fully embody Weimar Germany with almost zero ability to recover. Because unlike Weimar, not only is the United States essentially broke, but it's also insurmountable amount of debt to these, you know, the same groups of people. Because of course, if you look at the Federal Reserve, it's disproportionately controlled by this exact same group. So I say all of that because, you know, I always try to be very specific that it's not about hurting people, being violent towards people, rounding people up and removing them from a physical location. It is about identifying this amount of control and putting an absolute end to it. Because, you know, people might not like to hear this, but at the end of the day, the people that are participating in this machine are committing treason. They need to be held accountable for it. They need the law to take the proper protocols. And whether that means going to, you know, to court, to a military tribunal, whatever is the appropriate and just course of action, they will have to face the music. But that's not something that should be done via vigilante action, via violent overthrow, et cetera. We have an entire legal system that is designed to address this. And if they try and bribe or blackmail or physically threaten that machine to protect themselves, well, then we just need to use that as further evidence of the absurdity of the control that they have. And so we can fix all these things, but it starts with an awareness campaign. It starts with a conversation, and it starts with you and me and everybody that's listening doing our part to bring that about.
You know, you had mentioned, I think, earlier in a post that you were a little bit apprehensive about being the interviewee, but I think you're doing a fantastic job. Some of your answers are not only brilliant, but they cover a lot of ground, and that's what's necessary. Like, there's a lot to unpack. There's a lot of history that's happened, and I think you're right. Generally speaking, if violence were the answer, then we probably wouldn't be at number 110, right? Like, there were certainly pogroms in the past that would make anybody cringe, but even those did not really work. And at the end of the day, or I should say, coming to present day, they still maintain a tremendous amount of power and control over all geopolitics. They have for at least the last century. I've read books like the Great Red Dragon, which goes back to the 1880s, and the author of that book had already ascribed that not only did they control most of the finance that was flowing into America, most of the investment, they already had many Gentile fronts set up, the railroads, the Rockefellers. He went very deep into naming and just mentioned that all of these Gentiles were controlled by Jewish money. Of course, he was a businessman who had to travel to London to get financing. And even then, he had mentioned that basically, if you could remove all of these people from your country today, they could still completely economically dominate you because they controlled the shipping, they controlled the buying prices, the selling prices. And essentially, it set this up where, you know, all of the hardship, we kind of characterize America as a place that was born of hardship, of struggle, and of brave men that not only, you know, tamed and civilized the territory and the, you know, basically the wild continent, but also, you know, they brought trade, they brought industry. You know, America became an economic powerhouse during the Industrial Revolution. But all of the hardship, all of the difficulty, was generally artificial. Like it was the way he described it, that it was all intentional. And you could have, you know, in the late 1800s, bumper crops of some of the best crops out there. But the prices were kept artificially low so that the farmers couldn't make enough money to own their farms. And then, of course, the bankers moved in and buy up the properties. It was a really, really pretty deep expose for the 1880s on how this was being operated. And it went through the banks, it went through the large, massive corporations that were born from the Industrial Revolution. It was just really scary to realize that, you know, you're not only in a boat that's being captained by them, but the boat's owned by them, and they control the ocean as well. And so I found it really interesting that was his take over a century ago, and that they've basically just developed and consolidated this power since then, pretty much unchecked, with the exception of, you know, the Third Reich, which I tend to agree. I think that their economic turnaround was something that they had to not only make Hitler a bad guy and make Germany bad people, but the ensuing genocide against the Germans after World War II was very much indicative of the way that they operate with the Morgenthau Plan. Millions and millions of Germans were killed at Rhine Meadows after the war, after they had surrendered. The Eisenhower death camps are fairly well known. But this is kind of the way that they treat other people, right? Especially Christians. You know, and you'd mentioned a few things. I want to get into almost all of them, but there's not enough time. They don't care what it costs. Their domination has to be absolute. And I think a lot of times they're ascribed otherworldly power. Even in their own religion, they're treated as God's chosen, that they've got special favor, that they can't be conquered, that they should have their way no matter what, and that the Goyim are essentially animals. And I think that a lot of times Christians also kind of give them that credit because of certain things that are in the Bible. But really, they just have blackmail material on everybody. Like, it's really hard to think that these people are favored by any sort of divine mind, because they are blackmailing people and they are dragging them to islands where people commit terrible crimes. that are then, filmed, photographed, and recorded, and that material is held over their heads forever. And we see how corrupt that has made our leading politicians, our elites, captains of industry. They're very, very dirty in the way that they play. And of course, they cheat. They use nepotism. Meanwhile, they preach that they're favored by God, and that they're just smarter, and they're just better at business, and they're just all these things are kind of just a facade, right? I mean, these people are very criminally insane in a lot of cases. I think the Talmud, which you mentioned before, it's hard to tell if that's a product of a schizophrenic mind, or if it's the influence that causes some of the schizophrenia and some of the things that are so ingrained in them that we actually do see maybe we're seeing a genetic precursor, or possibly even an epigenetic result of this kind of activity. Have you read anything that's kind of bridged those two things together? Like, there is a tendency toward psychopathy. There's a huge proclivity toward I guess these sorts of mental illnesses, but that can also kind of tie in with their religion too. I'm not sure if you've read anything on that as well, but have you ever explored that possibility, that it could be the religion and the insanity of the Jew go hand in hand?
It's so fascinating that you asked that. So I did a space a long time ago with Simon Krims, who unfortunately was subsequently kicked off of X, and I think the reason for it is because he took it wasn't just scientific, it was almost a doctoral approach to the JQ, and he really tried to understand what are some of the genetic pieces, what are some of the psychological pieces, etc. So I did this space with him on the psychology of the Jew, and he started it off telling me the story of the Silver Fox study, which goes back at this point, probably about 40 years, 50 years, where basically scientists, they took foxes, wild foxes, like the animal, and they brought a bunch of them in, and they evaluated them. And they took them and they put them into two different camps. They had the peaceful, more docile camp, the ones that were less wild, and then the ones that were really, they were more rabid, they were more likely to bite, all that kind of stuff. So they put them into two different pens. And over the following almost 20 years, they exclusively bred the docile ones with the docile ones and the wildest of the wild with the wild. And generation after generation after generation, they noted what took place, which was that the docile foxes got to the point after about 7 or 8 years, so it was roughly about 2, 3, 4 generations of foxes, where they were able to pick them up. They would lick the faces of the scientists. They basically became like domesticated animals, like dogs. The wild foxes got more and more and more rabid to the point that they could barely even try and touch them without getting bit at, scratched, clawed, etc. And the reason that Simon started the story that way is because he then reverse engineered that the Ashkenazi Jewish line goes back to essentially four original mothers, they're referred to as, which is the more or less the birth line. It's like the hard fork of that group of people that goes back, if I'm not mistaken, about 800 or 900 years. From those four women, you then got a group of people about 600 years ago, if I'm remembering the exact numbers right, it's in the space if anybody wants to go listen to it, where you basically got to about 325 to 350 original Ashkenazi Jews, from which, if I'm remembering correctly, 80 to 90% of all Jews that identified as Ashkenazi derived from. And so his point in telling initially this scientific study and then some of these data points is that it is his belief, if you go back, if you try to envision 1,000 years ago, you've got pretty, relative today, you've got pretty primitive man. And his point was, what kind of woman would go out and leave her people, leave her tribe, leave her country, leave everything that her ancestry has known to go and be with this foreign group of men? And his belief system is that those four women were basically, for whatever reason, disenchanted, disenfranchised, or otherwise embittered with their lineage, their heritage. And that those people then basically became massively inbred. And just like the foxes, Perhaps there was something in the blood being continuously passed on by these people that was not just genetic. Because that's the wildest piece with the fox story, is that if you took the two foxes and you gave them to a scientist not familiar with the study and you said, "Can you tell me about these two animals?" the scientist would say, "They're the exact same things," because genetically they were. But they were behaviorally entirely different. And so it's interesting because if you overlap that with some of the theories out there on generational trauma, for example, it might carry that there is something that can be passed down through people that is more than just genes, that it's some kind of spiritual inclination. And so it is his belief structure, not mine, but I found it really interesting that perhaps there is something genetically unique to these group of people that manifest themselves through these types of behavior. And then, frankly, we could look at it and we could say the religious text begets the people, but it's not really a chicken or an egg because obviously there were people that created the text. And so what seems to be the case is that this predisposition for this type of outlook on the world, whether it's a and because if you look at narcissistic personality disorder, which he did a really interesting walkthrough, and he basically talked about the major presentations from a personality standpoint of somebody with NPD, and it's basically things like the envy of others, the belief of a sense of superiority, the demand of others to recognize that sense of superiority, the willingness to be completely indifferent to the consequences of your superiority on others, etc. He basically made the point that this is a genetic bloodline of people that, for whatever reason, have come to this point where they constructed the text as a manifestation of their sense of entitlement and superiority that is then used to reinforce the sense of superiority. And then if you unwind all of the things that we see in modernity, like if you try to envision yourself growing up as a part of this community, take for example any Western Jew, they're basically sent to Israel as something known as birthright, which is basically like a 2 week hiatus vacation over in Israel, where not only do they show you the history, the locations, the geography, but they also tell these individuals, they tell these kids that you need to be protected because you are going to be persecuted. You are chosen. You are special. You must continue your religion, your peoples, your faith, etc. And so it's almost as if the religion is nothing other than a self-perpetuating cult that is continuing the exact same ideological beliefs of entitlement and senses of superiority that go back at this point, according to Simon anyway, about 600 to 800 years. And so the number of generations that would be inherent in that, I mean, if we do the math, it's something like, it's not even 24, it's like 30, 35, 40, 50 generations where it's just been generation after generation after generation that has been programmed with this belief structure that everybody else hates them, and is simultaneously incredibly envious of them. And if you think of the type of person that would behave like that, well, what would that result in? It would be this presentation of, "I get whatever I want. If you won't give it to me, it's because you're a bigot and you don't appreciate that I'm special." And that's a really, really, really dangerous set of personality traits to have in a group of people, especially if those people have monopolized all of the various levers of control over a society.
Yeah, it's insanely dangerous. And big shout out to Simon Crimes. I'm a huge fan. I was a huge Simon Crimes. Well, let's just say I borrowed a lot of his content for my own show because it had been a great source of information. I think this is very interesting because he makes a great point that essentially what he's talking about is selective, is selective breeding. And the inbreeding over, several generations or tens of generations, dozens of generations, essentially eventuates in this type of being, this type of personality that's actually born this way. And I think that that's the same thing that essentially the Reich tried to do, is they essentially reversed this same reasoning and said, look, if you can selectively breed characteristics that are, I think they're often attributed as racial characteristics, and I'm not sure, how much revision was involved in that. But I think that essentially that he thought the same thing, that if you could, if you could take the Germanic people and if you could separate out the foreign influences, and if you had a Germany that was homogenous and Germans were breeding with other Germans for excellence, this was kind of the idea behind what he called the Übermensch, and this has been distorted since they lost the war, of course, to become the foundation of what they call white supremacy, which is not necessarily a belief that white races or the Aryans are superior to every other race, but it was that if you selectively bred for these inherent characteristics of maybe justice, law, I mean, you could just as easily have those characteristics as you could have selfishness, hatred, the victim mentality, the idea of a divine supremacy. All of these things, you could just as easily breed positive characteristics as well. And I think I think the fact that Hitler kind of took this idea and actually tried to base, his society on it, I think that really pissed them off. And I think that really was kind of reverse engineering something that they had been working on, like you mentioned, for quite, several hundred years, if not thousands. Has that ever, like, have you thought about that? I know that I've been called a white supremacist. I've had think tanks, call me a Nazi. And I'm really just a guy that really wants white people to be a part of the future and to be able to succeed as a people and to be able to love their race and their culture, because I see the same things that you do. I see people that hate their own culture. They hate themselves. And it's such a terrible thing to see from an objective perspective. And it even makes me think, maybe there are things about myself. I can't be unaffected by these things as well. Is it possible that that is the case, that over time, breeding for certain characteristics, especially if that's reinforced by a religion that they all happen to believe in as well, couldn't that also eventually make good, like super good people instead of just super evil demons? I mean, that's kind of nutshelling things a lot, but for the sake of brevity, that's the best way to put it.
Yeah, it's a good question, and I was just I was humbled to be part of a space just a couple of days ago with Jared Taylor, and he used the term pathological altruism in the space, which I know he's used quite a bit in the past, but it was really interesting to get to talk back and forth with him on this subject. And it's interesting because, we can talk about the inbreeding of certain groups of people and how it constructed certain traits that we see manifested. And it's not as if we are being, racist or bigoted in suggesting this. These are things that we've seen validated with scientific studies. Similarly, if we look at just evolutionary biology, which, I believe is a thing. Like I think we were created by something far greater than ourselves. I don't ascribe to the Big Bang, but I do think that basic biology is a very real thing. I think genetics are very real things. Some individuals that are like young Earth creationists say that that's crazy. And I mean, I personally think people are crazy to think that it's not real, but that's a debate for another time. But I bring that up because this idea of the pathological altruism, if you think about, let's just say Western whites hundreds of years ago, maybe thousands of years ago, here's a group of people that would have had to survive incredibly difficult, dangerous, and dynamic climates. So during the summer months, you have, certain seasonalities. During the winters, you have completely different ones. You have months where you have lots of sunlight, others where you have no sunlight practically, if you're talking about the Scandinavian countries. And so these are people who would have had to have very mid to long-term time horizons when it came to decision making, right? I think this is actually some of the reasoning behind the IQ variance between Western whites and, let's say, for example, sub-Saharan Africans, where, in Africa, you would have had very moderate climates, very predictable weather patterns, and you had food aplenty, whether it was a hunter or a gatherer mindset. Whereas, if you're up in Norway or in Sweden when the winter rolls around, it's not exactly like you've got animals just parading around in front of you to eat. And so I say all that because I think that the Western, largely white Europeans, as a result of those climates, not only did they develop a higher IQ, but they also had to develop a higher communal regard, right? Because you couldn't make it on your own. Not everybody was going to be able to be ideal for building a shelter or maybe for raising those crops that you needed to then store properly. And all the other types of considerations that you would have had in a more complex climate with a likely larger group of people. And we do know that, for example, in sub-Saharan Africa, you didn't even really have villages or communities. You had small little groups of tribes that tended to be, you know, kind of small. They would move around often in the white kind of what eventually became the white Christian Western world. You had communities that had to put importance on their compatriots that were with them in this journey of a very traditional or traditionally difficult lifestyle. And so I think it's basically that when you start thinking through these ideas, what you see is this pathological altruism where whites are very much so willing to say, I'm going to put my own self-interest aside for the betterment of everyone involved, right? And that's a very... It's a wonderful trait to have when everyone operates under the exact same system. But that has been what has been utilized as the Achilles heel in the Western world, as the media and all these other things have been able to basically attenuate into that and to use that as their weapon. And through things like the desire for empathy, guilt, shame, etc., they've basically convinced them to put aside their people, their heritage, their, you know, their prosperity, etc. But I do think that the silver lining here is that when we start awakening the masses to this collective problem that is essentially, you know, muddying the waters that we all swim in, once that poison or the toxin is removed, there's going to be the ability to construct a beautiful tomorrow that is ultimately, in my belief system, it's ultimately going to be best served with homogenous nations. And in those homogenous nations, those cultures can then thrive, because at the end of the day, you know, that pathologically altruistic society, when left to its own devices, will build wonderful, beautiful things, exactly as you saw in post-Weimar Germany. That doesn't mean that it has to all be one race, one hair color, one anything, but at least has to be a similar moral compass that is guiding those individuals with a largely homogenous genetic aspect to it. And so, you know, my goal, my vision is to create that larger conversation so that first we remove the toxin, then we start recognizing the benefits of homogenous societies, that ultimately individuals return to those, maybe with some outliers here and there. Look, if people want to live amongst what is known today as diversity, then so be it, right? Allow them to do that. But don't force it on everybody at threat of gunpoint, social shame, etc. And I think that's going to inevitably create a balkanized future tomorrow, both in Western Europe and likely in the United States, that will allow for a return to those value structures and those kind of like the innate ethos that exist amongst different peoples, which in my belief will be the most beautiful of things, because you could have a future society where, you know, the unique qualities of every different race and group of people is going to be magnified rather than being minimized, which is the ultimate goal of kind of woke, diverse, you know, collectivism, which at the end of the day is what is required for Zionism to ultimately succeed.
You know, that's a great answer. And it's kind of funny coming into this. I knew that we didn't exactly align on everything, but I firmly believe that everybody, you know, should be able to make up their own mind and you know, kind of figure out where they themselves stand on the question of race or of future ethnostates. And, you know, a lot of these things get thrown around very, very quickly and very early on in these discussions. But my friend Carl Rattle has kind of framed these things as questions to be addressed later, which, you know, I tend to treat these things that way, because, you know, no individual one of us in any particular conversation is going to lay down the law that's going to be followed in the future. But this will come as a result of a lot of, you know, a lot of debate, a lot of discussion in the future. And so it's something I see kind of used as a wedge that's driven between certain groups. But at the same time, it's something that's easily talked around, and people, you know, who are willing to be responsible moral adults should be able to at least have these conversations without, having to cling to, you know, those that particular set of beliefs, like whether or not you believe America should end up as an ethno state, or a lot of people leave open the door for diversity in the future. I think what you mentioned about, it's kind of funny what you'd mentioned about kind of how these groups were at in separate latitudes came up in different societies out of necessity is actually something I read directly from Mein Kampf. And I noticed that you have a lot of parallel thought with Hitler himself, if assuming Hitler wrote Mein Kampf. I know that's also arguable, but I think the chapter on nature and race actually laid out that exact same situation as a reason for how these things came to be. So I don't think you're far off. I tend to agree, but that was mind-blowing when I read that. I never really thought that a part of the big reason that people are different is not just because of the environment that they're brought up in, but also a long-term evolution of these people and where they came from. And it to me, it kind of points to an inescapable, but not totally dominant, aspect of evolution, which we definitely know, you know, is real to a point, right? Like cross species evolution, no record of, right? But but generally we see mutation, we see selection, we see things happen. So you can't simply just rule out these kind of things. I've come to find
well,
that.
And
go ahead.
And on that real quick, just to add in a little nugget, the on that line. So I do think that, you know, there are pressures that exist that do kind of play into, let's just loosely call it kind of this Darwinian idea of evolution. But one of the things that is utterly astonishing to me, that is almost unknown in the masses, is this very uncomfortable truth that Robert Seffer talked about, and I was fortunate enough to talk to him maybe, I don't know, 6 weeks ago, maybe 8 weeks ago. And we were talking about evolution, and in particular sub-Saharan Africa, is this idea that up to 19% of sub-Saharan Africans' DNA is unique just amongst them. Almost 20%, almost a fifth of their genetic makeup is only found in sub-Saharan Africans. Now, that means that it's not in not just whites, but it's not in Asians, it's not in Latinos, it's not in Hispanics, it's not in Middle Eastern folks, it's not in anybody. It's just amongst them, which tells us. And when I read this from Seffer, I thought, okay, this has to be one of those crazy ideas. This is surely outlandish. And then I looked into it. And sure enough, by most scientists, it's just loosely referred to as, I kid you not, ghost DNA. That's actually the term
ghost DNA
that is used. And if you look into ghost DNA, and it's basically, it is a lost ancestor of the sub-Saharan blacks. And what that essentially means is, and this is something that should be obvious to us. If we look at whites, we look at Asians, we look at all the different peoples of the world, there are fundamental differences. If you take skulls of these human beings, not only can you and I look at them and recognize the differences, you can take the skulls of people and give it to AI, and they can tell you their race based just on the skull. And what does that tell us? Well, that tells us there's something fundamentally different that's not just evolutionary, it's not just the color of our skin, and as a result, it's not just these minor differences that might manifest themselves through IQ, EQ, temperament, all these other things. I mean, we are in many ways as different amongst the races as a Labrador retriever is from a poodle, is from a pit bull. And we don't like to talk about these things. We like to pretend that all human beings are the same, even though you could look at different variants of wolves, for example, entirely different species of wolves. And they will look nearly identical to you and me and people that have, you know, no experience identifying the different variants of wolves. And yet they're totally different. But we can see you and a sub-Saharan black and an Asian person and a Middle Eastern person, and we're all supposed to believe that we're just one in the same, just with slightly different exposures to sun levels and different biological pressures that existed across our quote-unquote races. Like, it's wild that mankind has been brainwashed to believe something as preposterous as that.
I agree. And it's definitely been a very, very clearly heavily pushed on us that this idea of equality, and it seems to me to be completely political. I've since just ascribed that to the same, you know, Marxist revolution that we're tied into. That it's pretty clear that people are different. It's pretty clear that the races are different. And yes, to convince people that we're all one race, yet there's 27 species of honeybees that you can't tell one from another. That to me it's become funny, and I've even joked about it just because it's so it is so shocking and it is so crazy to believe that people believe that, you know. And these are supposed to be, these are people that you're appealing to. To begin to think critically, and it almost makes a joke out of the idea itself that you can snap these people out of it, you know. And so I try not to dwell on that too much because I begin to get a little bit black-pilled, but I like to generally give people the benefit of the doubt and believe that if we're capable of becoming conscious of these things, that they're also capable. But it's going to take a level of honesty that maybe they haven't reached, you know, for themselves. And they're going to have to disbelieve some of the things that they've been told. A lot of this process has been unlearning things that we've been taught, at least for me. You know, maybe if I had noticed things 20 years ago and kind of taken a more organic path like you did, maybe that wouldn't be such a consideration. That's an interesting thing to think about. There's a couple things that you mentioned, and we're going to run out of time because I could talk to you for 10 hours and probably still not get everything. But I do want to ask a couple of things because you did sort of mention them. I guess the last thing I want to ask about, but I don't want to forget about it, is kind of you talk briefly about what things would look like if these influences were gone, if we could kind of shake off this programming and how beautiful the future could be. And that's definitely where I want to end at. But first, we had talked also a little bit about racists, about racism and about the ideas and prejudices and different things that people have. I've noticed that there is definitely a racism that is based on hate. It's based on probably, where can I say I saw it first? Probably after the riots, right before COVID from George Floyd. I think we saw kind of a betrayal of a social order, and I think a lot of whites really became very racist during that period when they saw, you know, cities being burned down, basically saw racial animus being allowed to be expressed on one side while the other side was physically kept in their homes and not allowed to defend themselves. And since then, they've really just used that momentum and that leverage to continue to divide people in our society, which is unfortunately, I mean, right now it's a diverse society. There are many different races here in America, and we see this being used by the powers that be to continue to drive division. And that's been what's so infuriating about watching the mainstream media operate. Once you kind of realize the play, you see them doing this over and over. And even in my own household, my elderly father is just bought into this stuff. And all of my appeals toward rationalism, all my appeals to critical thinking, just go out the window. Like, the programming is very, very strong. Should this be about flipping the normies and kind of getting everybody awake? Is that even possible? Are there people, is there a large segment of people that are just not ever going to wake up?
Well, I do think that there's unfortunately a very large amount of the general public that they're going to come around. But frankly, and this is really unfortunate, they're going to come around when it becomes unpopular to not, is probably the way that I would think about it. And
right.
You know, and we've seen this firsthand with, I think COVID serves almost a perfect microcosm for this entire JQ. And what I mean by that is, you know, very early on, you had the conspiracy minded individuals that, you know, I was kind of in this camp. I wasn't on the bleeding edge of it, but I certainly was very distrusting of the media. But you had the folks early on that noticed some of the really unusual things. Like, for example, and this is the one where I first said to myself, okay, I know that we're all being lied to. And it was the fact that Google Earth had removed the Wuhan lab from Google Maps. And a friend of mine noted that it couldn't have been more than a maybe a month or two into the offset of COVID. And he had a side-by-side image of Google Earth cached before and Google Earth presently, and they had just removed it from the map. And so my point in bringing up COVID is just that, like, you have the folks like us in this space that are the early adopters of the JQ. As with COVID, as things went on, as it got more uncomfortable, as people got more annoyed, they started to become a little bit more willing to speak out against the narrative. Right? A year in, a year and a half in, 2 years in, people started saying, okay, I'm not going to put on my third mask and get my third booster. Clearly something's wrong. And now here we are years after the end of COVID, and even your moderate-minded people, it's essentially at this point, it's almost all conservatives are now in agreement that COVID was, if not just a scam, that it wasn't a malicious bad act. And you've even got a lot of Democrats that are coming around to it. And similarly, the same thing's going to happen with the JQ. We need to make enough noise that we bring attention to it and that we awaken the eyes of those that are especially curious and open-minded. The more uncomfortable things get as a result of us having these conversations, which unfortunately is going to involve them tightening free speech, maybe trying to pass laws against the anti-Semitism, kicking us off of platforms, in doing so, exposing the obvious double standards that exist. Like, the more pressure that gets applied from this absurd group, the more it accelerates the awakening. And so, I think there are a lot of folks that are, they're going to be the laggards, right? They're going to be the ones that only now are starting to realize that something was wrong with COVID. Don't waste a moment of your time with those individuals. The people that we need to be talking to are those that are furious about what has been happening with the genocide of the Palestinians. Some of those are leftists, a good number of them actually. We need to be going after those folks. We need to be going after the folks that are upset about COVID. We need to be going after the folks that are under the belief system that Donald Trump is going to make America great again. And with all of them, we need to use these different elements. So we need to say to the leftists that empathize with the Palestinians and now with the Syrians, we need to say, why do you think this is fucking happening, right? And apologies for the F-bomb. We need to go to the COVID folks, and I do this with Liz Churchill all the time, because every day she posts about COVID and Bill Gates and Fauci, and they need to go to jail. And every time she does, I'm in her comments as quickly as I can, being saying something to the extent of, "Hey Liz, do you want to discuss who is at the top of almost every one of these vaccine companies?" And then I have a post. That it doesn't just have my words, it has the words from what's considered to be the Jewish Nobel Prize, talking about how above all of the other overrepresented Jews in the COVID response was Albert Bourla, and that he's a champion for humanity, right? And I have that video, and all of the people that go to her page and think she's a hardcore right winger, they notice that she never responds to that. Her post might get 100,000 views. It might get 1,000 likes. Mine might get 5,000 views, and it gets almost as many likes as hers does. And what's my point is, the people that are COVID curious, they're going to notice that stuff, and then they're going to notice the absence of that conversation. So we need to go after those folks that are pissed off about COVID. We need to tell them who was behind the vaccines. Who was behind the government agencies that did all these lockdowns? We need to go after the people that are pissed off about the kind of the lurching communistic move within the left wing. And we need to say, well, where do you think communism originates from? Right? So we need to use all these different points. We need to basically, like a jujitsu warrior, we need to take their energy, their momentum, and we need to use that momentum to flip them onto their back and to say, no, you're not going to complain about COVID without complaining at the people at the top of those companies who are overwhelmingly Jewish. We're not going to let you complain about inflation and the massive printing of our currency and the fact that you are getting poorer. If you want to complain about that, let's look at who's running the secretary, who is the Secretary of Treasury. Let's look at who's running the Federal Reserve. Let's note the unusual overrepresentation of that group of people. We can't let them complain about health, the dwindling health of the American people, without noticing that we have a Jewish transgender as the Secretary of Health in the United States. Right. So we need to keep using all of these complaints and flipping people over and saying, look, 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 and just keep pointing. And the folks that won't see it, the folks that don't want to see it because they're afraid they're going to get called a slur, don't worry about those folks. Just move on to the next individual. And eventually, I guarantee you, as our movement grows, those people who are afraid of being called the slurs, give them a year or two, and what they're going to be more afraid of than being called an anti-Semite is an idiot by all the people who are saying, how do you not see the pattern?
Exactly.
And then there's far more sheep than wolves, so don't worry about the sheep for the time being.
One of the things that I find happens a lot, especially during these big brain interviews, is the good guests tend to make my segues for me, and a lot of times they actually respond to something before I ask it. And I think that's happened at least half a dozen times during this interview. You've actually pre-sponded to a lot of questions that I have. So you've made this really, really easy for me, and I appreciate that. But you addressed – I love the way that you address COVID as a microcosm. I do think that that's very, very applicable, and it's actually brilliant. I've noticed that people who people who were very easily fooled by that, they're not any less easy to fool now, but they're much more apprehensive about being vocal about it. I think that you're right. There's kind of a shame that will come out in the long term of being on the wrong side of that thing, and I think we're already starting to kind of see that. Man, I could really take that off into the weeds, but I'll hold off on that, and let me just kind of reorient things. Headed toward the future and kind of with the vision of what victory looks like in mind. And I think you've kind of already touched on this a little bit, but can you, what is your vision of victory? It will be personal, and, you know, it's not really a matter of agreeing or disagreeing with it, but I've noticed that everybody kind of has a different vision of what the victory state looks like after it's done, you know, What does the nation or the world look like to you? And I realize that's a big question, so you can take as much of that or as little as you want. Ultimately, the next question I'm going to ask, I always ask every guest, what are three books that you would recommend to the relative normie that was becoming aware of this JQ, and they wanted to know more? Maybe they didn't trust Alex Jones. Maybe they want to take their kind of own path. But what are three books that you would recommend that people read? That's also, you know, voluntary question. You don't have to answer if you don't want to. But the vision of victory in three books, that's one thing I usually ask everybody.
Well, I love those two questions. And I'll start with let's start with the vision for victory, and then I'll explain why I think the books would help in that pursuit. And one of the books will be laughably comedic in some regards. But I think the what does victory look like? It's very simple. It's healthy minds, healthy bodies, healthy spirits, and a healthy economic model that allows for genuine prosperity of the people, which, because of the aforementioned values, will not be the desire for materialism, for lust, for vanity, for hedonism. It will be the pursuit of a better tomorrow for future generations. And I know that sounds very lofty, but once upon a time, that was the major metric of a healthy society, was whether or not your children were going to have a better life than the one that you were able to experience. And it's so wild that for over 100 years, in a survey that's been done on this, generation after generation after generation, this is the first generation going all the way back to the Great Depression, where individuals believe that their children will have a worse life than the one that they were given. And that is, it's just demonstrative of all of these pieces that come together to create this dystopia that we're living in, where folks, things like suicide, depression, anxiety, SSRI use, alcoholism, violent crime, poverty, all of these things are skyrocketing at astronomical levels that really is only comparable with the conditions of Weimar in recent recorded history. And so what victory looks like is of course the removal of the things that is bringing that about, which we've talked about, you know, very concretely in this space. But through their removal, it's the replacement of all of the value structure that's been drilled in by this vile system that basically at the end of the day prioritizes nothing but dopamine hits as a means to, you know, coping with another day, whether the dopamine is via the SSRIs, whether it's alcohol, whether it's legal drugs, illegal drugs, Tinder, right? Whatever it is, video games, pornography, all these things that merely allow us to live like animals off of the impulses that are being used to manipulate us as if we're in Las Vegas, right? Whether it's in the video games given to a five-year-old, the smartphone given to the 15-year-old, the pornography that's available for everybody, all those things, right? Those need to be taken away. They need to be withered down. And we need to return, as Asha Logos has said so brilliantly, we need a return to the land. And when he says that, it's not just a physical return to the ideas of farming and kind of the agrarian cultures of old, but a value structure that's built into, as Yoda said, and I'll sound super nerdy saying this, but the rocks, the trees, the wind, the distance between you and me, right? That we're all part of something far greater than ourselves. And that to live for that, right? What we do in this life echoes in eternity. A beautiful quote from the movie Gladiator that ironically, it serves as a perfect microcosm of how drastically things have changed. For anybody that's seen the reboot, the remake, whatever you want to call it, you could go back only 20 years ago and we had a set of cultural values that put faith, family, friendships, masculinity, it put all those at the top of a set of hierarchies that was used to frame the world the way that we know it. And today those have all been dismantled, which is why every Hollywood blockbuster you go to feels hollow. It feels artificial. It numbs your senses. It creates dissonance in your soul. And it's because the perversion of our culture has become so shocking that even growing up amongst a relative rendition of modernity, whether you're 15, you're 25, you're 50, you're 75, you look at the last 20 years and you realize something's drastically wrong. So the victory is removing that, removing the villains that are creating that and normalizing it. And in doing so, bringing ourselves back to a cultural yesteryear that was so much better for everyone involved. And I think in that process, the last little thing that I'll say is just that needs to not only it not only needs to feel like yesteryear, it needs to look like yesteryear with a removal of the absurd diversity that has been artificially thrusted upon the Western world, not because it's righteous or it's good, but because it's convenient for the people in charge, because they can use it to destroy the homogenous white world that stands as opposition to their Zionist communist utopia. And so we need to return individuals to their homelands, and that return to the land is something that if everyone does uniformly, if Hispanics go back to Mexico, Brazilians go back to Brazil, all the folks from Central and South America that have flooded into the United States, all the blacks that have flooded into Europe from largely Africa, if they all return to their relative lands, and in the process we remove the central banking system from all of those nation states, then all of them can uniformly act as the National Socialists did in Germany. And in doing so, can beautify their cultures, their people, their lands, their economies. And we can have truly beautiful diversity where you can go and visit Norway, and it's entirely different from visiting England, different from France, different from not just the United States, but different from Florida to Texas to California. They can all have their own flavors and feels, which is exactly what diversity should look like. And it is the antithesis of the diversity that's pushed by this vile culture that we all live in. Now, to your three books, the way that we get there is by awakening people to the perpetrators, which at the macro level is a manipulation of the financial systems that we are all living in. And so there's two books that everybody should read on that front. I'll use these for two of my three, because I do believe that the financial manipulation, the usury, this is their biggest and boldest weapon. And so you need to read, folks, the Stephen Goodson book, The History of Central Banking and the Enslavement of Mankind. It goes over not just the Federal Reserve in the United States, but it goes over the last 3,000 years of manipulation via central banking, all the way back to the Roman Empire. It talks about how this has been basically put in place all over the world, and it doesn't directly say it, but it pretty much hints at the perpetrators of this uniform problem. The second book is The Creature from Jekyll Island, which not only talks about the construction of the Federal Reserve, how it came about, but it also explains how the banking system has enslaved everyone in the Western world to that select set of individuals under a system that's not just the invisible hand of the Fed, but it's also the localized banking system that is providing you with your checking account, your mortgage, which the word itself translates to death grip, right? And so to understand how all of your banking is a manipulation to basically rob you of your wealth and your prosperity, and that a end to that system is a more prosperous tomorrow for you. Don't forget, folks, the freedom fighters of the Revolutionary War got up in arms and threw all the tea into the Boston River over a 1% to 2% tax. You're currently giving over 50% of everything you make to this machine. Okay, so those are the two books, because you have to understand the financial system, which at the end of the day exposes the people behind this problem. The third, and this will be the cheesy book, is Can't Hurt Me by David Goggins. And I'm not up here to shill his work, the importance of being physically fit, but I do believe that a very small percentage of people can change the world. But you have to be able to speak about these issues, and you have to be able to present yourself as a confident, competent individual. And no one will ever take somebody who is sickly, who is unhealthy, who is incapable of taking care of themselves and their body. No one will ever take that person seriously. And so I think for anybody that wants to speak out on these issues, that wants to make a difference, we have to think the part, speak the part, look the part, feel the part. And in order to do that, it's incredibly important to have that sense of confidence, of conviction. And there's no better way to get to that from a physical standpoint anyway, than to physically take care of your body, which will not only build muscles and endurance, and it'll protect your cardiovascular system and all those things, but that confidence that will be delivered as the result of being physically fit will give you an additional degree of mental and spiritual sharpness that you cannot fake. So I don't think there's anybody better to listen to on that front than David Goggins. The guy is a physical machine. He's about as inspirational a person as you could find when it comes to that aspect. And the guy has walked the walk. He's talked the talk. And he's got a very colorful set of language that I won't necessarily always align with. And I'm sure there's lots of other books that are out there that are equally beneficial on that front. But I think he's a really inspirational guy. And there's a lot of humility there, because in addition to his successes, he's happy to talk about his failures, his shortcomings, and to use those to further strengthen the mind and body the way that he does. So those are three books I think are really helpful and maybe a vision for what I think victory would look like, at least in the short term. In the long term, how that entrenches itself is it's a more challenging and multifaceted question, but hope that that's helpful.
It's been extremely helpful. And actually, I don't think it was there wasn't a silly answer in there. In fact, I'm very impressed and I'm very humbled and happy that you chose to say yes to my interview invitation, because this has been a tremendous and thought provoking conversation. And I think we've gone through a lot of the main points, but I would really love to be able to have a conversation again in the future. I'm going to keep an eye out for your spaces and any other way that I can, kind of interact and continue to kind of further the conversation, because I think it's something that we definitely need to talk more about We definitely want more people exposed to these kind of ideas. The books are always a great recommendation. I happen to turn a few of those into audiobooks every now and again. And I want to say thanks, because one of the things I've noticed since I've kind of become aware of the movement, as we call it, is that there was it was rare to find somebody who was willing not only to coordinate and to collaborate on things, but there was not anybody seemingly taking the lead on bringing people together and having those conversations. And really, a lot of it is kind of messy, but hashing out some of these ideas. And I've noticed that you've really taken the lead on, you know, having these conversations. I've noticed you dragging, you know, Tony Blinken on Twitter, and I thought, wow, that's really ballsy. But you're always doing it kind of politely. I noticed that you form things as a question. You know, you actually make the JQ a question, and then, like you said, you attach that with backup to guys that I wouldn't screw with. You know what I mean? Some guys I think, you know, like maybe I'll get in trouble if I troll a certain person. You seem to be fearless in that regard. You seem to be a take charge kind of person when it comes to hosting spaces, getting involved in the conversation, and I think we need more of that. I think there needs to be more of that sort of leadership and more of that impetus on really taking inventory on what's really at stake, and then realizing that there's not much personal that you can spare yourself or save yourself by not facing these things head on. And I think that's really the mark of a leader, and I hope that you continue along this path, and I hope that we can all do it without getting banned from Twitter. But I do feel like that's coming eventually. I have one more question. It's a fun question. It's not, you don't have to take it, it's not serious, but I've already gotten a whole lot of negative feedback because I use an older picture of Jeff Goldblum than the one that you use. You use the young Jeff Goldblum with the you know, the dark hair, and I use the picture with gray hair and big glasses, and a lot of people are already mad at me about that. But could you please tell everybody that you're not Jeff Goldblum, and that I used a just a fine picture?
Well. If I was, I'd have to talk like this all the time, and well, it's it yeah, ooh, it would tire me. No, I'm
I waited you for to quote. I waited for you to throw in a Goldblum quote or reference. I did not detect one throughout the entire interview, but it was a great opportunity.
No, I'll tell you, I wish I could roll my R's. I can't do that. And if I could, I'd make for a much more convincing Jeff Goldblum. But I do, you know, it's interesting. I'll give you a couple quick things. On just conduct on X, I would really strongly recommend to everybody that's out there to understand the terms of service of this app and to notice the patterns, which basically, and I've learned this unfortunately the hard way in many cases with posts being marked as hateful conduct and all this other kind of stuff. By the way, almost every time I go after Blinken, I ratioed Netanyahu. That was one of my all-time favorites. I didn't think it was going to be possible, but about a week after I did, I got a post randomly labeled as hateful conduct and had a lot of my kind of visibility was turned way down for maybe 2 or 3 weeks. So there are consequences of kind of punching up, intellectually speaking, at some of those folks. And so I do think it's best to stay away. So sometimes I just can't help myself. It's like trying to bite my tongue. But I think the best thing that we can do in the JQ space, like I said, about, you know, issues on COVID, posts from Alex Jones talking about the globalists, right? What we need to be doing is under all of those posts, we need to be sharing the uncomfortable questions that they are not addressing, right? So I talked about Liz Churchill, and she always talks about the vaccine. So I was always just say, hey, have you noticed this weird pattern, right? And then share some supporting information. And so it's really important, folks, don't make statements that are in any way able to be perceived as hateful. We're merely asking questions. We're merely being curious. Ben Shapiro himself went on like a 5-minute rant about, well, you're just asking questions and you think you're hinting at something, but you're just asking questions. So why don't you come out and say it? And he was clearly so unhinged. And the reason is because if, like Glenn Beck used to do actually on Fox News, he would say, I'm not saying that Michelle Obama's a man, but this is kind of weird, right? Like, yes. We can be doing similar things when it comes to the JQ to make sure that we're playing within the rules. We're not never, ever calling for violence, because frankly, they have a monopoly on violence. We're not going to win with any kind of uprising or rebellion. We're going to win by having communal voices that are shouting out in front of all the major spheres of power across the Western world that this has to be discussed and it has to be put an end to in a way that's peaceful and that's law abiding. So I really, really think that it's important that we play their game the way that we have to play it, even if it means, you know, not always speaking as bluntly as we might like to. And when it comes to these topics, folks, you know, every time I post one of these questions, inevitably, I have people underneath that are replying and saying, you're an anti-Semite, you're a bigot, why are you a racist, all that kind of stuff. Don't give them a moment's notice. Just click the block button and move on, because for the most part, not only are they individuals that will never agree with us, but a lot of them are paid actors, and they are paid not just to clog up the timeline, but to get you unhinged so that you respond to them in an angry fashion, you slip up and they say something that gets you kicked off the platform. And then you're just like Chutes and Ladders when you were a little kid, the little board game, you're all the way back at square one trying to rebuild your account with a limited audience, right? And bingo. So we need as many warriors on the battlefield as we can possibly muster. So and on those same lines, we need to build alliances. And that's why I will talk to anybody. I don't care if it's Simon Dixon, whose mom is Jewish. I don't care if it's Suleiman or Khaleesi or some of these other figures that some individuals in the JQ spaces say are too moderate. They're not aggressive enough, right? Like, I've gotten to the point where Suleiman, who I appreciate. I know he doesn't go as hard in the paint on the JQ as some of us might like, but he talks about Zionism all the time now. And he brings me into his spaces with thousands of people listening. And he knows, like, he teased the question up. He knows that I'm going to smack it out of the park with something that's going to be very, very heavy handed on the JQ. And he allows me to do it. And my point is, everyone was attacking me saying, why are you in that guy's space? He doesn't call it like it is. Well, guess what? Because I'm in the space, I now get to call it like it is. And so whether it's the 1488 folks and Handsome Truth and those guys, if they invite me in, I'll go in. And they'll give me crap because I'm not fighting enough for exclusively white pride or something along those lines, whatever right. It is. They'll attack me for X, Y, or Z. People will attack me for going into Suleiman space. They'll attack me for time talking to Simon Dixon. They'll attack X, Y, and Z. They'll attack me for talking to Stu Peters, because he once had a sponsor who was a Jewish-owned gold company, oh, right? Man. But Stu Peters, he has 800,000 followers, and he comes into my spaces, and the people in them double or triple, right? We get thousands of people sometimes in those spaces because folks like him or Myron Gaines, who has some, you know, some hot social takes that people don't like. But the point is that the way that we win is by getting our priorities and talking points to as many ears as we possibly can. And so we need, I mean, Ben Shapiro could offer to talk to me in a space tomorrow. I would happily take it because he would bring his audience. And you yes. know, I might lower myself because I'm debating a Jew or whatever it is people would criticize me for. But it's like, if we're able to make a bigger impact, it doesn't matter if, you know, a conversation with a person brings in one new ear or 1,000 new ears, because every additional warrior that we get, folks, in our camp, they are never going back. Because once you pull away the curtain and you see that it's just a man that's creating all the smoke, you no longer fear the wizard, and you'll no longer pay attention to another thing that the big mighty Oz has to say to you, because you know it's all a lie. And so every warrior that we win is never going back. And I guarantee you, they will convince not just one or two, but prospectively an entire community of people to join in our cause. So just know that every day, every conversation, every person that you get a chance to connect with on these topics, that if you're out there and you're fighting this fight, you're spreading this awareness, you are a warrior that is walking in the footsteps of something far bigger than yourself and your immediate tomorrow. Because this, at the end of the day, is a fight between good and evil, and the side of good is not the side that's currently conducting mass genocide, enslaving people, and believes in a tomorrow where all of us are merely useful cattle for their machine. That is obviously the antithesis of the good, which means that we are on the side of that which is righteous.
Totally respectable take. Totally, I'm with you. Like I even if we don't align, I absolutely respect that that you're willing to put all of those things aside and continue. Like a diversity of tactics and a unity of purpose will eventually succeed. I do firmly believe in that. And even though we may all take different ways, we would all do things a little bit differently. The fact that you're doing something is commendable, and I really appreciate. Again, that you actually kind of take leadership in the space, that you're willing to jump in and have these conversations with anybody. I think that's absolutely commendable. And, you know, I can only wish you all the success possible in the future. And hopefully we can all, you know, join together and be a part of that success. Guys, we've been talking with Ian Malcolm for the last 2 hours. Ian Malcolm of Twitter Notoriety, who's been absolutely gracious and very kind to donate a couple hours of his time to come talk to us on the show. I hope that we can have you back in the future sometime and maybe do another one of these. But I want to be respectful of your time. I want to say thank you for coming on the show. And is there anything that you'd like to plug, or is there anything, any projects you're doing that people can support, or you know, any ways that people can kind of follow what you're doing outside of Twitter?
No, I mean, I keep a pretty lightweight digital footprint, and a lot of that is unfortunately due to the realities of this machine, right? If you speak about these things publicly as a non-anon, you face all kinds of realities on the professional front, the personal front, etc. So I basically have this as a sole vehicle for some of this stuff. So if anybody wants that's out there that's listening, you know, wants to support, we regularly hold spaces. I've got a couple of them coming up, some with people that are in this space right now, and they range. Like I tend to focus a lot on this topic of the JQ and kind of the detriments on humanity that it is constructed. But we go into things, we're doing a couple spaces in the next week alone on, we're doing one on women's health. We're doing one on COVID. We're doing one on substance abuse. And then a whole bunch of things that are looking, for example, at Weimar Germany, kind of unpacking how things went from a intellectual and spiritual depression to a complete renaissance, how that politically manifested itself. Going to be doing that with a guy named Space Cat on Twitter. But you know, the last little thing that I'd say is when it comes to like supporting me, don't worry about supporting like my Twitter ambitions or my personal account on this platform. The best thing that you could do to support the ambitions that I think we all share is to just do whatever part you can play in this larger mission. You know, my Twitter account, I'm not monetized. I didn't even have intent on being a premium user of the platform because they wanted a credit card and a phone number and I wouldn't give it to them. But somebody quote unquote gifted it to me. And I say that because, you know, my aspirations aren't to fill a product or to, you know, build some kind of monetary benefit out of this. It's merely because I feel like I would not be able to lie my head on a pillow at night if I weren't speaking about that which is looking to literally envelop the world in this tyrannical oppression. It is there. It's right in our faces. And like I said before, once you wake up to it, once you're Neo in the Matrix and you unplug from the computer and you look around, there is a empathy and a guilt that I would feel. An empathy for the people and a guilt for not doing anything if I wasn't just actively spreading this awareness. And so, you know, while a larger following or a couple shares of posts or any of those things, you know, that might spread my message. The message that we need to spread is the awareness to this issue, the detriment that it has to the society, and most importantly, the beauty that we could all experience if once, not if, but once we get rid of this boot that's on our collective necks. So I'll plug in one more book, actually. I talked about the financial ones. I should not have left off the 84 at the end of my user tags in reference to Orwell. If you've not read 1984, folks, please do so. Animal Farm is a wonderful 100-page book that basically gives you the play-by-play of what happened under the Bolsheviks in Russia in 1984. It doesn't just speak of a dystopian future. It tells you what we are living in. It is the reality that we all exist in. It is the matrix before its time, and it is of monumental importance because once you read that book, you start to look around and you realize that not only is the JQ constructing this artificial existence that we all experience, but that this has been long developed, that every apparatus of modern society plays a part in manufacturing and perpetuating it. And it's only then you can understand how complex the situation is, and as a result, why we need to take it down. So, that's my call. It's not for selfish ambitions, because frankly, I don't have them, and it's not because I'm pious or, good-natured or any of those things. It's just because at the end of the day, I recognize that from a selfish perspective, if we're not all communally fighting for this challenge to be removed, then none of those personal ambitions matter aside from the little bit of dopamine that, frankly, I could get playing a video game for 15 minutes
Right, with a lot
unwinding.
less risk. Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, man, this has been a fantastic interview. Thanks again for taking the time to hang out. I think I'm going to cut it here and drop the space. I want to thank everybody who came to the space. I thank everybody who's tuned into the show. And most of all, thank you for taking the time. Like I said, you didn't have to come talk to an obscure Anon, but you did. And I think we're all much better off for it. I couldn't, personally, I can't disagree with much because you actually you have a very well thought out position, and you're very honest. And yeah, not that we would be adversarial, but I find when people are honesty, when honesty creates kind of an armor that makes you a bit bulletproof. And I think that extends to what you just said. When you're actually just in this for the benefit of all, and you're not actually in this to gain anything for yourself, that you'll actually be much more effective and much more powerful ultimately by being, honorable and pure like that. I think it is a kind of a purity. It is a spiritual movement that we're in. And so if it's not a spiritual act that you're committing, then maybe, reassess and rethink. But that's going off also into the weeds. Thanks for coming on. I'll just leave it there because there's nowhere I could go but further out into the weeds, and I could do this for the next 5 hours. Very, very interesting to talk to you, and I want to say thanks again. I'll probably have this clipped, and you'll probably see this interview, floating around on Twitter or on some of my live streams as well. With
Hey,
that.
well, feel free to share it any way that is helpful. Anything that I have out there, what's mine is, or intellectually what I've put out is, it doesn't belong to me. It belongs to the movement. It belongs to you. It belongs to a better tomorrow. So, clip anything, share anything, borrow anything, and to everybody that's out there, I just want to thank you for listening in. Thank you for the unusual rides that we sometimes went through, and I just hope all of your audience have a good day, good morning, good afternoon, wherever they are in the world. And just know, like I said before, that if you just stand tall, if you stand proud, if you speak the truth, like you said, Flood, you are invincible. So don't back down from the slurs or any of the other things, because you can know that you're wrapped, whether it's a religious, a god that you look to, or just an energetic kind of rendition of karma and all those other things. Just know that when you're living in that which is righteous, that you're basically impervious to all that is evil. So just God bless to everybody. Flood, thank you so much for having me. And I'm always here, whether it's for you or anybody else that's listening. Feel free to reach out. My inboxes are always open. I hope everybody has a fantastic day.
Guys, go follow this guy at Ian Malcolm 84 on X. And when you see him in a space, go in there and listen. And if you're so inclined, grab a mic and have a conversation. This is how we process these things. Thanks again. I'm going to end the space now and wish you all of the success and luck in the world. Goodbye.